Hello, and welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, November 24th, 2023. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. This Saturday marks the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women and the start of the 16 Days of Activism Against Gender-Based Violence. This annual international campaign was started by activists in 1991 to call out and speak up on gender-based violence. This week on Rabble Radio, Rabble editor Nick Seabrook sits down with Andrea Gunraj, the Vice President of Public Engagement at the Canadian Women's Foundation. The two discuss the ways gender-based violence shows up in Canada and what you can do to prevent it. Gunraj has 20 years of experience in community-based program development and communications and a passion for innovative public education and nonprofit leadership for social change. She is a trainer, public speaker, published author, and holds a master's in criminology from the University of Toronto. Here's Rabble editor Nick Seabrook with Andrea Gunraj in conversation. Take a listen.
Hello, welcome, Andrea Gunraj, Vice President of Public Engagement with Canadian Women's Foundation. Thank you so much for joining me here at Rabble today to discuss the 16 Days of Activism Against Gender-Based Violence and National Women Abuse Prevention Month.
Thanks so much for having me.
Just to get started, first, can you tell us a little bit about the Canadian Women's Foundation and the work that your organization does on the issue of gender-based violence?
The Canadian Women's Foundation is Canada's public foundation for gender justice and equality. And we do everything that we can to support women, girls, and gender diverse people, that's trans, two-spirited, and non-binary people, to move out of violence, out of poverty, and into confidence and leadership. And a lot of the work that we do is very much about supporting organizations in every province and territory to have the programs that they need in place to help abuse survivors rebuild their lives after abuse and actually prevent abuse before it starts, because it can happen in a prevention and an intervention way. And we also support the kinds of systemic change that needs to happen in Canada to make sure this abuse reduces from the epidemic levels that it is now to zero. That's our goal. We want everybody to be free from all forms of violence and fear of violence. We're not there yet. And it's been a really heavy time when we've seen the numbers just increase in Canada and around the world.
Yes, and I'm glad that you brought that up, because according to the Canadian Femicide Observatory for Justice and Accountability, the number of women killed in Canada has risen every year for the past 4 years to 184 in 2022. Why is it that it seems to be that this problem is getting worse?
That's a great question. I mean, we've seen, in Canada, a woman or girl is killed by violence every 48 hours, often by a man that is in their lives. And that gives us a bit of pause, because we know that in the pandemic, women's vulnerability has increased, and vulnerability for women, for two-spirit, trans, and non-binary people often translates to greater unsafety and greater abuse. There's lots of reasons for that, but I think one of the key things that we have to see is that there is a sexism that plays out. There's a patriarchy that plays out, that women and gender diverse people are seen to be the ones that you take your frustration out on. And especially in intimate partner violence situations behind closed doors, this happens far too often. And, you know, we went through a lot of stress in the pandemic time. But what we see is that a lot of the stress that happens behind closed doors gets released on family members. And the most vulnerable family members tend to be women, tend to be children. Sometimes it's elders as well, too, who are in the family. It could be people who are vulnerable dependents. So we have this dynamic that plays out in families, in communities. We know this plays out. We know that women are taken for granted. Women's labor is taken for granted. Women's well-being is taken for granted. Even in public spaces, you know, women and gender diverse people are told, watch yourself, be careful, guard your drinks, hold your keys in your hand, Don't wear unsensible shoes. Watch where we go late at night. Don't go alone. It's this expectation that even though we're in denial about the rates of this gender-based violence, there's an expectation that we're going to be unsafe in our communities. So you see, it's bigger than just a dynamic that plays out at a one time when people are stressed out, maybe just behind closed doors. It's this expectation in our society that women are to be unsafe, that we're to guard ourselves, that we're often responsible for the violence that plays out against us. And then those of us around people who are going through violence, we feel ill-equipped to even respond to it, to say anything. It's a subject that we don't like talking about because we find it ugly. We feel that nobody that we know would experience it. Unfortunately, the data tells us otherwise. The data tells us that two-thirds of people in Canada know somebody, know a woman who has been abused. So clearly we have this difference between our understanding of an issue, our kind of sense of what we do about it, and our sense of our denial as well.
Now, you mentioned that society and social attitudes seem to put the emphasis and even the culpability on gender-based violence onto women rather than on men, who you mentioned most often are the perpetrators. Why do you think that is? And do you think that is starting to change at all?
You know, why that is very much patriarchy. Good old-fashioned patriarchy that's not so old-fashioned, that finds ever new interesting ways to remix and revitalize itself. And I think, Nick, you're right that things are changing. And I think this is the promising thing. I am not disheartened by the questioning that people are doing about gender-based violence, bringing things out into the open. I really credit survivors for their strong voices, for saying me too, and coming up against a lot of abuse when they say this happened to me. Now they're helping us see why we have to do something about it and why it's such a common issue. I'm also crediting feminist voices for just always being hardcore about bringing this out, speaking against this violence, saying that it shouldn't happen behind closed doors, and we shouldn't feel like there's nothing we can do about it. And we shouldn't just go to the same old solutions that don't work: police, prosecution, and prison. We should think proactively, and everybody should be involved in that. It's not just one group of people. So I do think that there are some things that are changing, but I do think patriarchy and sexism and this idea of marginalized people, one group of which is women and gender diverse people, anybody who experiences gender injustice, that they're the ones that are going to be living hard lives. I think this is something we have to really question, and we have to wonder, why are we okay with this? I ask men, what are you doing, cisgender men, to stop this dynamic? What are you doing to question this in your workplace, in your community, in your place of worship, in your home? How are you living out the values that I know you believe in? Similarly, with those of us who might experience this, and sometimes we might feel like, well, we blame other people because it's easier to blame than to see our own risk. How can we question this about ourselves? How can we turn from stigma and silence about violence to support for survivors? I think if everybody did this, this violence would not be nearly as common or as acceptable as it is today. We have work to do, but I think things are moving in a great direction. We have to just keep at it.
And, you know, in terms of the causes, you mentioned earlier that we saw a rise in gender-based violence during the pandemic. The pandemic also coincided with the rise of Andrew Tate became very popular, Joe Rogan, these very, you know, toxic male figures in the media space. So could you talk a little bit more about what are some of the causes of gender-based violence? And do you think that these figures are a symptom or a driving force that they're part of the problem?
That's such an interesting question. I mean, I think that there is this sense that fascism and, you know, authoritarianism, this idea of let's get back to basics and back to basics looks bad for many of us. Whatever that looks like, this idea of a resurgence of white nationalism, a resurgence of colonialism and colonial sympathetic thinking. You know, we have a lot of forces that play against this. And I think one of the things that we have to remember is in times of what we see as crisis, moments where we feel there's been a real upheaval, this is when the shocks lead to this kind of thinking, this idea that we have to keep power dynamics in a particular way that privileges men, privileges cisgender people, privileges people who are like the same folks with power, and puts people with less power in a bad position. And that's a simple way of saying it, but probably too simple of a way of saying it. But then when you get people who are saying, no, we need gender justice. No, we need racial justice. We need every form of justice that we've been missing. Yeah, there's going to be a backlash. I say that, but then I also feel quite hopeful that I'm seeing strong voices speaking out against this at the same time that you see these kinds of strong negative voices playing out, these strong authoritarian, non-power sharing voices. So I question our patriarchy again. I question our colonial dynamics and addiction to capitalism again. I question the ways that we look at extracting and hurting one another and keeping power and not shared power. Again, it's a very simple way of thinking about it, but we know that in the shocks of the pandemic, and we're going to see more, you know, maybe the pandemic is now decreasing as a shock. We're going to see some huge climate crisis hitting us again and again on top of wars and conflicts and the pains that we're experiencing in our communities around the world. So we are going to have to be very persistent about how we fight for justice and speak out for justice and how we vote along those lines and how we support the causes that we see that we know are for human rights. We're going to have to be really strong about it and increasingly so and never give up, because I do think that these things have changed. We've seen things shift in 100 years. We've seen a lot of things shift, and we can get really pessimistic about it because it hurts. But let's look back at history and remember that it's the voices who are marginalized, who have been underheard, who have made themselves heard, who have gotten a lot of things moving. And I say that for the feminists as well that are going to be listening. Keep at it, and let's support each other as we keep doing this.
Absolutely. And, you know, you mentioned earlier gender diverse people. You mentioned indigenous women who I believe have a higher risk of experiencing intimate partner violence. Could you speak to a little bit about those issues and maybe about who is most at risk of experiencing gender-based violence?
Thanks for asking that question, Nick. How important it is. So we know 44% of women experience some form of physical, emotional, or mental violence from an intimate partner in their lifetimes. And that is just from an intimate partner. We're not talking about coworkers. We're not talking about strangers. We're not talking about necessarily brothers and fathers and family members. So that is a shockingly high rate in and of itself. And we see even more shocking numbers when we look at First Nations, Métis, and Inuit women who have a higher rate of violence and femicide. We see higher rates of violence for anybody who's marginalized. So we think about women with disabilities. We think about younger women, women in the North who are more isolated and may have less access to resources and help. We also see greater risk for people who are two-spirit, trans, and non-binary people, just astronomical rates of targeting. And we also see this dynamic that's starting to play out more and more about gender digital harassment and hate in online spaces as well, too, really out of control, and partially because this behavior, this kind of commentary is quite monetized in digital spaces. It makes people a lot of money, so there's very little incentive to change that. So we do have this high risk of people who are experiencing multiple forms of marginalization, and I'm talking about racism, sexism, ableism, all the isms that play out and combine together to put them at higher risk of gendered abuse. So when we think about solutions, we can't do a one-size-fits-all. As I said, police prosecution in prison is not where it's at. It's not going to fix it. And we are going to have to be really proactive about giving people what they need, seeing their uniqueness, and giving them the resources in their communities to come up to the solutions that actually work.
And you mentioned a few of these spaces where gender-based violence can occur. It's not just in the home. It can happen in the workplace. It can even happen online. In fact, you even mentioned we're seeing it more and more happening online. And can you speak to how that impacts the victims of gender-based violence? How are they impacted? And earlier you also mentioned that children are impacted. How can that impact their development as well?
Well, this is a really good question. I mean, for me, I see two things happening. I think it's really important to talk about the violence that does happen behind closed doors and intimate spaces. This is like a thing that we just haven't talked enough about. So I appreciate that opportunity. But I'm so mindful of the fact that this violence is quite woven through our lives in workplaces, in communities, in places of worship, in public transit spaces. In anywhere that people are, this violence finds a way to weave itself through, and even in digital spaces, as you said. So I also want us to remember that these are spaces that can be very unsafe, and they need tailored solutions. So, you know, sometimes people are saying, well, we need more shelters. Yes, absolutely. We need more shelter support. We need more crisis lines. Yes, absolutely. We need more crisis lines. But does that help the people who are dealing with, say, hate and harassment and violence at work? Does that put women at risk of sexual assault and sexual violence in their workplaces? Does that help them to call a crisis? crisis line, what is happening in your workplace. Maybe not as much. Does that help you when you need to go somewhere to be safe? Would a shelter help you in that situation? So it's actually, we have to get a lot more ambitious about the ways that we support people in this violence. And I go back to this all the time, but you know, we put billions of dollars every year, again, into legal solutions, police, prosecution, and prison. But unfortunately, this violence is underreported. Less than 10% is actually reported to these systems. And these systems only do things when something has already happened, something bad has happened. What about before, when, you know, maybe you can actually intervene and stop it from happening and stop the untold trauma? Why aren't we thinking about that? Why don't we put billions into that? Instead, we're trickling very small amounts of money, just thousands. So sometimes when we're lucky, some millions. We need to get up to billions, and we need to get that ambitious. That's why I go back. What are we asking our leaders? What are they doing? MPPs, MPs, what are you doing? If you want my vote, you better have an awesome solution to gender-based violence. And I'm not talking more policing. I'm talking the things that actually work on a community-based level. And then when you talk about children, you know, I think we have to look at it also from that preventative lens. We know that when you experience this stuff when you're young, it has so many reverberations in your lifetimes. It makes life really difficult for a lot of people to live this experience and then also have to feel it and try to build better relationships, healthy relationships, after you saw that from the people who were supposed to care for you and from the people that you love the most. Well, let's think about prevention here. What are we doing in schools? I always go back to the fact that schools do not have a clear standard, healthy relationship programming in schools from zero to when people are getting into post-secondary. That is an incredible opportunity that we're missing out, and it's very uneven across regions and territories. And in fact, we've seen some school boards roll that off. How silly, how foolish. We should use the opportunity to create healthier people, to help people who maybe are dealing with this stuff at home, give them an outlet to say, hey, that's not right, what's going on, and I need support. So again, I think about, yes, the untold trauma, the under-measured trauma, the unseen pains, and I think, what can we do about it? And I think that's why the Canadian Women's Foundation is so focused on prevention.
Yes, and you've mentioned several times, you know, that police and prosecution isn't the answer. I'd like you to go a little bit more into some of the answers that you discussed, and maybe how they can be achieved. You mentioned lobbying, you know, political leaders, but we have a very conservative government here in Ontario. And do you feel that ground is being gained in reaching real solutions?
You know, it's such a great question. I think, okay, three things, simple things that I think anybody can do, because there's lots of things and there's lots of resources and solutions and whole tax structures you have to change. So let's keep it simple. Number one, I want to ask everybody, what are you doing to be prepared to help somebody in your life who's going through violence? Most often the survivor goes to somebody that they know and trust. They do not call 911. They cannot go to the police. They're not safe enough. So I think about, are you a kind, safe person to help this person? How do you let this person know that you are going to be non-judgmental? In the beginning of the pandemic, I told people that my friends and family, you know what, there's a few people that I know who I worry about. I don't know what they're going through, but I just worry that they might be at risk of violence, at high risk. Well, in the beginning of the pandemic, I knew the risk would increase. I reached out to them and I said, hey, if you need anything from me, I will listen to you. I will support you. You just don't even hesitate to come to me if you need me. And I will do the best that I can. And I won't tell you what to do. I will support you. And I was really saddened and also pleased to see some people within the pandemic take me up on that offer. And I was able to refer them to something in their community to get them the help that they needed. Some people left a violent situation. Some of those people stayed in the situation, but they got support in that situation. I don't care what they choose to do. They got to do what's right for them. But I want to make sure that they're supported. Well, I think everybody in Canada can do this. Why not? You know, we know that you might be a friendly and kind person and you want to help, but are you making that known to people? Are you saying things that are helping them feel like, yeah, you're a non-judgmental person. I'll go to you if I need something. We can all do that today. Again, in our neighborhoods, in our communities, in our workplaces in particular, we can absolutely help a workmate, because I think sometimes we talk about this stuff at work and we feel it's unprofessional somehow. Nope, that conversation is changing. We see mental health is important at workplaces. Well, this kind of health and well-being is important too. That's number one. Number two, when you're ready to vote, you know, the elections are always coming And you're going to be asked by people, you know, please give your vote to me. Well, your vote is precious. So you can ask the question, wait, what are you doing about gender-based violence? And we know the rate is higher. Femicide is up. We know who's at higher risk. What are you doing specifically? Are you going to have some kind of a plan? Or is your plan going to work? Tell me, convince me. And if we don't like the answer, we don't have to give our vote to them. And, you know, I am agnostic about parties many times. Like I do believe that every party has a responsibility to end violence. So if you don't like the answer from one party, you can go to another party. You can ask the same question. And you can just make sure that your vote is being heard in this way. And I know it can be difficult to feel this way, but this is democracy, and we have to remember that. Use your democratic vote in this way and get specific about what you want to see. And if you don't like the answer, don't give your vote. The last thing I would say, where are the areas of influence in your community? And are you a person that has some level of influence? We all do. Can you support somebody to know more about this, to get the help they need, to be aware of two or three services? I'm sure you can. Think about those ways. Just think about three ways and go ahead and try to do them today. And that's what I would ask everybody for the 16 days. It starts November 25th and extends to December 10th. If we all did those three things in that 16-day period, let that be a little testing ground. I bet you're going to be surprised at the kinds of exponential benefits you can see afterwards.
Absolutely. And, you know, this is such a large subject. I have so many more questions I'd like to ask, but we're coming up short on time. So just before I let you go, could you explain to our audience a little bit about what the 16 days of activism against gender-based violence is?
Well, the 16 days of action is just something that happens every year around the world. It's observed. And here in Canada, with the Canadian Women's Foundation, we're trying to get people to do something for each of the 16 days, again, starting in November 25th, extending to December 10th. So I would ask people, go to CanadianWomen.org. You'll see a calendar of 16 days. Specifically, I would say as well too, we have a training that is easy for people to take on their own time to learn how to become a signal for help responder. So the signal for help is something that we released a few years ago. People have used it to get help in a dangerous situation. It's just palm up, thumb tucked, thumb trapped by fingers. And women have used it in dangerous situations all around the world. Now, signal is only as good as its response. So people can go to signalresponder.ca and get access to that free training. It'll take you 1 hour. Just learn how to respond to it. It's very simple. And that idea of you being a supportive person to survive in your life today, that will give you what you need.
Fantastic. Well, Andrea, again, thank you so much for joining us today to speak about this important issue.
Thanks for having me.
That was Andrea Gunraj, Vice President of Public Engagement at the Canadian Women's Foundation, and Rabble editor Nick Seabrook in conversation. Thanks so much for that, Nick and Andrea. Now it's time for a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. And for that, let's turn it back over to Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week in labor news, the Ontario Federation of Labor elected a new executive team at their convention in Toronto. Laura Walton, Ahmad Gayed, and Jackie Taylor were elected president, secretary treasurer, and executive vice president, respectively. The three new executives ran on a unified ticket dubbed Team Ignite. Walton has served as president of the Ontario School Board Council of Unions and is a member of the Canadian Union of Public Employees Ontario. Gayed is a grocery store clerk and a member of the United Food and Commercial Workers, and Taylor is a community worker and a United Steelworkers member. President-elect Walton said that the priorities for her team include addressing the high cost of living, lack of affordable housing, and what she called a corrupt provincial government that is in the pocket of wealthy developers. Staying in labor news, Canadian unions are pushing for a lasting peace in Gaza. A temporary ceasefire was recently announced between the Israeli government and the Hamas organization that controls the Gaza Strip. While unions are welcoming this news, which will mean a temporary halt in the bombing that will allow humanitarian aid to reach Palestinian civilians, union leaders are demanding that a permanent peace be reached. Canadian Union of Public Employees National President Mark Hancock said in an emailed statement to Rabble that his union cannot accept that the destruction of innocent lives will resume in a mere few days. Hancock added, quote, "What we want for ourselves, what we want for everyone else, As trade unionists, we believe everyone deserves to live in safety, dignity, and peace. End quote. In environmental news, environmentalist David Suzuki is arguing for the benefits of carbon pricing. Canada is currently seeing a nationwide debate over whether or not the national carbon tax should be scaled back as the weather gets colder. Suzuki pointed out that not only do leading economists say that carbon pricing is the most effective way to reduce emissions, but that it also promotes affordability. Suzuki writes, quote, "Putting a price on the pollution that causes climate change and other costly problems encourages everyone to reduce emissions. By cutting back on damaging activities or shifting to cleaner, less expensive technologies, or both." End quote. In national politics, Rabble contributor David Kleimenhage analyzed a recently leaked email between conservative elder statesman Preston Manning and conservative MPs from the Calgary area. Earlier this month, Manning released a report commissioned by the Alberta government that encouraged further politicization of the public healthcare system should another pandemic arise. Manning's recommendations would end mask mandates and vaccination requirements for healthcare workers and put decision-making more into the hands of partisan politicians. In his email to conservative MPs, Manning encouraged them to use his report in a future federal election campaign to attack the Liberals. Kleimenhage explained how this was just another example of how public tax dollars are increasingly being used for partisan political purposes. And finally, Rabble freelance writer Paul Weinberg reviewed Ken Cuthbertson's upcoming book, Blood on the Coals, The True Story of the Great Spring Hill Mine Disaster. In 1958, one of the worst mining disasters in Canadian history occurred in the coal mining town of Spring Hill, Nova Scotia. The collapse of the Spring Hill mine tragically led to the deaths of 75 miners and destroyed the town's economy, a disaster from which it never recovered. Weinberg takes a look at Cuthbertson's telling of this story and the impacts disasters like this can have on small communities. To read the full versions of all the stories we talked about today, please visit rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Do you want to hear Rabble Radio on your local community or campus radio station? It's easy. To learn how, please email editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.